You may not think of yourself as a public speaker, but I bet it's not that far from the truth. It doesn't have to be interviews with reporters. Your words can spread from multitudes of growing media. Insert your new favorite social video app here. Ralph Waldo Emerson said, "Speech is power. Speech is to persuade, to convert, to compel."
What is the DNA of business marketing? How do we market ourselves now and in the future? Brand communications is evolving. Are you? Let's explore together. Spiral upwards. This is Spiral Marketing.
Welcome. This is episode 4. Today's show is about mastering words in the media. Our guest has an exciting background and ability to positively empower us to speak about our brands to the media. Mary Spaeth is the founder and president of Spaeth Communications. She has deep experience and she has a unique background in communication strategy and media consulting, which includes serving as the director of media relations for President Reagan. She's a frequent speaker on communications theory and a university teacher in Dallas, Texas. Can you share a little bit about what keeps you passionate for mastering words in the media?
Well, I keep passionate, Carl, because we've had wonderful opportunities from our clients. And that stretches what we do at every level. So for example, when I had the great good fortune to go to work for President Reagan as the director of media, as you mentioned, the world was just beginning this remarkable change in communication technology. And the media office at the White House when I was there is responsible for local media and trade media. So the banker's press, the women's press, all that press belongs to the media office, not to the much better known White House press corps, press office. And the press office doesn't actually own the media office. The media office reported to the chief of staff differently. But so the question was, all right, how do you serve the press outside of Washington, D.C.? When I got there, they were sending out 4,000 press releases a couple times a week. I said, you know, nobody's reading these things. It's dead news. But over at the Agriculture Department, I had made friends, and they had started this neat thing with what was ITT Dialcom, and it was called the Internet. And of course, nobody had ever heard of it. And you're much too young, but maybe some of our listeners will remember when you used to put the phone in the rubber cups and you dialed and it went me. And if you had an account with ITT Dialcom and you had a computer and a monitor, up would pop this thing called the White House News Service. It was item number 51. On the internet. And it was just a black screen with white lettering, but it was everything that I could collect from the White House and the executive branch and load onto this. So that if you are a reporter in Indianapolis or Dallas, or you worked for Women's Day or whatever it was, you could get exactly what the White House press corps was getting. And sometimes you could even get it before them. And I want to tell you, although my children roll their eyes when I talk about it now, for its time, it was very, very cool. So when one gets to do things like that, and at every iteration of our being, we've had some opportunity from our clients to invent things and help them transform their business. And that is ultimately the most exciting thing I think that anyone could be involved with.
Now, what do you mean by invent things?
Well, it means looking at things in a new way. I'll give you another example. There's a program for hospitals called Nurse Magnet Recertification, and only the top few hospitals achieve what's called magnet status for their nurses. And it's very arduous. It's not unlike the Baldrige Award. You apply for it. It's a very competitive process. And we were bought in probably 10, 15 years ago with one of our large clients that wanted magnet certification. And it said, we'd like you to apply your communication model and your teaching to our nurses and first analyze, you know, what it is that we need to do and see where you can add value. And one of the things that we found is that nurses are trained to be very factual. So you would ask them what we call a yes-no question. Okay, something like, you know, are you struggling to fix hospital acquired infections or HSA? And then they say, oh, yes. Okay. And then they go on at length about the problems of hospital acquired infections. But you'd ask them a question, you'd say, well, are there chances for professional development here? And they'd say, yes, there are. And they'd stop. You know, they wouldn't go on. They wouldn't take the opportunity to tell the hospital stories. And so what we did was, we said, we need to set up a training program where we reorient how nurses think, at least in this situation. So they come away from this thinking that it's all right to talk about themselves, that they're an important part of the hospital story. And that, in fact, if people are going to hear the hospital stories, they have to be the one to actually tell it. Now, that's turned into the program called Employees as Ambassadors, which a number of our clients are now using, recognizing that your employees are your best advertisement. But 20 years ago, that was a really new way of thinking.
I see. That's a wonderful story. That's a wonderful couple of stories, actually. And I gave a few points related to your background, but I'd love to hear a little bit more about your story as it relates to mastering the media.
Well, my late father, who was a doctor, used to say that I took my resume and turned it into a biography to cover up the fact that I could never hold a job for more than a year. And there was more than some truth to that. But I've been alive at a great time. Communication has been changing. Doors for women in the 70s started opening up dramatically. And so what I've done is bounce around from opportunity to opportunity. I started off as a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer back when we had two deadlines a day. And we typed, if you can believe this, on manual typewriters, type, 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 zing. And then you had to return the carriage yourself. In the mid-1970s, I got interested in cable television, which was then a brand new medium. And I was the producer of the first cable show that was financed by general advertising dollars. We had a show called Manhattan Weekend, and we covered all the things to do in Manhattan and the five boroughs in New York over the weekend for Warner Communications. And we had a team of reporters. And the Bankers Trust Company decided to experiment with advertising on this new medium. And we advertised something called the Miss a Month Loan. I still remember all the words for it. People really thought they could miss a month on their mortgage. And that got me really interested in thinking about all the new ways that there were to communicate and to looking ahead to how things were going to be different in the future. So although I've stayed as a writer, and as you know, I do a great deal of writing, at every step of the last 30, 35 years, I've been thinking about what's the next horizon, what's the next frontier, what's the next way to reach out, engage, and influence people. And communication is the platform, it's the way of thinking that lets you organize that.
Excellent. Well, I know that one of the things that you do is you help people speak better in the media. And you help people deal with negative questions and make it difficult for the media to spin it in a negative way. And if you don't mind, I thought we'd have fun with a question, which is, do you have any regrets in this field?
That's a great question. And I think it's much better to be optimistic. And if you were to ask me if I made any mistakes, if we were to reframe that a little bit, Carl, the answer would be plenty. I've made plenty of mistakes. And I hopefully view them as learning opportunities. I think that's a better way for me to address this, because if you spend your time regretting things, you're looking backwards. And I am absolutely an optimist. You know, I'm talking to you from Texas. And when I announced to my friends in Washington that I was moving to Texas and leaving my dream job at the White House, they all said, oh, how can you do that? Oh, Texas. And I said, listen, I'm going to love it even if I hate it. And that turned out to be a great attitude. You go into things thinking positively, and it's a much healthier than thinking negatively. Now, having said that, what would you like to tackle next? Do you want to tackle what we think is the most common mistake in the media, which is repeating and denying a negative?
That's perfect. I appreciate you going through that little exercise. And I think that your answer was wonderful. To focus on the topic a bit more clearly of mastering words in the media, I think it might be nice to give the listeners a little bit of context for the issue or field overall.
Absolutely. Let me take a step back, if I could, Carl, and tell your listeners how we got started.
Perfect.
And what our first few insights were, because then that will shape how we cover the material going forward. I was, as you mentioned, working in the White House dream job, married the chief of staff of the Department of Justice, who was one of those Texans. You've all met those obnoxious Texans that want to get you in a corner and tell you that Texas was the only state that was once a nation and would be again. And my husband's name was even Tex. So we arrived in Dallas. And on my first day in business, I had a call set up with the head of Southwestern Bell Telephone. And they had just started an enterprise-wide quality initiative. And as part of that, they were sending employees out to talk to customers. And he turned to me and he said, "Mary, it's the darndest thing. What we've discovered is that the customer doesn't remember what we thought we told them." And it was an epiphany for me, but I realized I've approached communication thinking about what I wanted to say or what I thought somebody needed to know. And of course, the minute you ask how much do people remember from what you say, a lot or a little, everybody knows it's just a little. In fact, Carl, it doesn't matter where I go in the world. When I ask people, how much does your listener remember from what you say, a lot or a little, people know it's just a little. And I was fascinated by that. I wondered if anybody'd studied it. So I thought, if you knew what makes people remember things, you would do so much better. So that was our first day in business. Our second day in business, we had calls set up with a big healthcare system based here in Dallas, the Baylor system, and with the national practice of audit practice for Arthur Anderson, which was then based here in Dallas. And they both hired us just based on this insight, but they gave us different assignments. Baylor said, "We need to figure out how to get everybody involved." And that's become this Employees as Ambassadors program. And Arthur Anderson said, "We need a model and a methodology." And so we have a model that we've developed called the Influence Model, which aims to influence and understand what people hear, what they believe, and what they remember. And our first next insight in this is that we pick up and repeat each other's words. And once you're clued into that, it really does transform how you see the world. And we very simplistically divide this up into good words. They're the words that you want repeated, and bad words, which are the words that you don't want repeated. And it's very easy to see how this works. The most common mistake in communication, not just with the press, but in general, is repeating and denying negative words. And when people do that, the listener is likely to overlook the denial and hear the opposite of what the speaker is trying to say. And we named the genre for a young woman who was caught with a high profile, but unfortunately married to somebody else, man. And she held a press conference and she announced, "I am not a bimbo." Thus, of course, causing everybody to think that she was. And so when you repeat and deny a negative, and you see this all the time, companies say, you know, "We are trying to cover up everything." Well, of course, that's what you think about. So the first thing you do when you're approaching a topic or an issue is you say, "What are my good words?" Okay. And then, "What are the negative words?" And the first thing to understand is that you never repeat negative words, because that becomes the soundbite. That doesn't mean you won't get them in questions. You get them in questions from reporters. You'll get them in questions from other key audiences. But you've got to have a very clear idea of what your anchor words are. And again, this is not just with a reporter, because the whole concept of media today has broadened dramatically.
Absolutely. I think it's worth repeating, don't use negative words in the media.
I do want to keep broadening this out, Carl, because it's not just the media. We had clients are only good examples, so this one will be unnamed. But last year, one of our clients had a major reorganization. It's a big company. And one of the executives got promoted, got new responsibilities at the same time that their functions and departments were reorganized. And he had a first meeting with his new direct reports and his existing direct reports. And people wanted to know quite reasonably what's going to happen to the people that we used to work with. And the executive said, later insisting he meant to be funny, he said, "Don't worry about them. They're just losers."
Well, oh boy.
Before the meeting was over, thanks to texting, that comment had gone virtually global. I think the guy was telling the truth. He has a sort of snarky sense of humor. And this also reminds us that you always ask first, who's my audience? Because in this case, the people who had worked with him knew he had this sort of dry, cynical sense of humor, but the new people didn't know him. And so when he said, "Don't worry, they're just losers," they took him at his word. And once those things I hate to use a hackneyed metaphor, but once that horse is out of the barn, very, very hard to get it back.
You'd mentioned that there's a few specific challenges that come up over and over again that might be helpful to talk through.
One of the things that we should raise for your listeners is the concept of how you listen to a question, particularly from a reporter. And rather than thinking of yourself as being in a position to answer the question, we encourage people to think of themselves as responding to it. And that's because our next insight is that the role you assign yourself tends to have a significant influence on how you communicate. And particularly with a reporter, where they ask the question and then you as the interviewee are supposed to answer it. Okay. There's a tendency to accept the words in the question, the parameters in the question, and the topic of the question, instead of asking, who's my audience and why am I doing this? And one of our next insights was to say that when you listen to a question, you want to acknowledge hearing it. But the concept of acknowledging it is quite different than answering it. And it was clear to us that any short, truthful phrase that indicated that you've heard the question would be accepted as a substitute. And we actually have an acknowledgement card with a bunch of handy dandy phrases on it that will help people get out of any sort of question. So for example, one of the most common types of question is called a framing question, like a yes, no question. And one of the examples I love, I'll reach back in history, is Bob Schieffer asking President Clinton's lawyer, do you admit that the president committed perjury? And that's of course a yes, no question. This is his lawyer. So we expect the lawyer to say, absolutely not. Instead, he begins by saying, we have to look at the question of the standards. And of course, everybody immediately jumps to the conclusion, he's ignoring the question. And so, yes, the president did commit perjury. Now, the lawyer commences a very long answer. And at the end of it, he ends up by saying, so no, we're not admitting that. But it's too late. We had certain expectations as listeners. And because he violated them, we're listening differently. Now, and the next level of that is to say, just because a question is framed a certain way doesn't mean you have to pick one of the topics. You can substitute for your own. So, for example, where you start in an interview is very important. And I have another wonderful example, brand new this year, of Karen Katz, who is the CEO of Neiman Marcus. And they opened up in China this year. And a Bloomberg reporter begins by saying, we need to have a hard time with the Chinese government. And instead of saying yes, no, Karen says, well, let me back up a minute, because there's something she wants to put on the table about Neiman's expansion and the demand for Neiman's brand worldwide before she tackles the question about their relations with the Chinese government. So the difference between thinking I'm going to acknowledge hearing the question and I have to answer it as asked for us is night and day. And one of the most useful things I think your listeners will get out of this podcast.
Interesting. Can you restate that point in maybe just a sentence there?
The role you assign yourself has an influence on how you communicate. In a Q&A situation, such as where the reporter asks a question and you think you're responsible for answering it, there's a tendency to accept the words, the parameters, and the topic of the question instead of asking, why am I doing this? If you think of yourself as someone who owes a response to the question, and that the first thing you want to do is acknowledge hearing it, no matter how the question is framed, any short phrase that conveys, hey, I heard you, is actually accepted by the listener as responsive and puts you back in charge.
Beautiful. Thank you. Do you have a... either a mantra, quote, or a story would be acceptable, but I think, do you have any influential mantras or quotes that you think might be helpful for somebody who is embarking on a path of media communications?
Well, anecdotes or stories are critically important communication vehicles because they humanize facts. And I began to think about the importance of stories as a communication tool before I went to the White House when I was at the Federal Trade Commission as the Director of Public Affairs. And the FTC is, as you know, an important regulatory body. And a lot of regulation is driven by anecdotes. Something happens, oh, write a regulation to prevent that. And I realized that you don't counter anecdotes with facts. And as far as I could tell, we just needed better anecdotes. And the experience that crystallized this for me is in a story called The Hair Braider. And let me set the scene for your listeners. My boss, Jim Miller, was an economist. He was the chairman of the Federal Trade Commission. And he tried to educate people about how regulations can be used by existing business interests to prevent competition. So he would talk about economic terms like rents, R-E-N-T-S. And I would say, Dr. Miller, most people think that rent is what you pay for your apartment. You know, you're speaking in a language that shuts out your listener. We need to find a different way to explain to people what we're talking about. And into my lap fell this story called The Hair Braider, courtesy of the Washington Post. And the story goes like this. A young African-American woman living in Washington, D.C. Her mom was a single mom raising her daughter by herself. And she started at the age of 8 or 9 to braid hair. She got good at braiding hair, so good at braiding hair that her mom's friends started to pay her. And so she started to build up cash, and they had up like a pretzel can in their kitchen, and it filled up to the top with cash. And when it got to the top, the mom thought, this is a lot of cash. And so she opened an account in a credit union, first bank account they'd ever had. And the daughter, who was by now 14 or 15, began to think, gee, I need to finish high school. Maybe I should even go to college. I could have a career. I can be a business person. In swoops the Washington, D.C. Board of Cosmetology, and it says, you need a license, and it will cost you $1,000, and you need to go to cosmetology school. And the girl said, but you don't teach hair braiding. You teach cutting and dyeing. I'm only interested in hair braiding. And they said, doesn't matter. So sorry. And they shut her down. Wow. And everybody who hears that story understands that that's how you explain how established business interests use regulations to freeze out competition. So you can say all you want, businesses use regulations to shut out competition. It doesn't mean anything to most people. Tell the story of the hair braider and they get it in a heartbeat.
That does put a new angle on competition. That was a wonderful story.
We do, I think, Carl, a lot of work with the banking industry, with the state banking associations, the American Bankers Association, and banks across the U.S. For as long as we have been in business, I have been saying to bankers, stop talking about what bankers need and talk about what you do for your communities and what you do for your customers. And what we want them to do is tell stories. And I just heard a wonderful story from First Financial, which is headquartered here in Texas at Abilene. They're in 40 communities in Texas. And one of their customers came in, and his mom, who was in her 90s, was being ripped off. She had lost her entire savings to people who prey on elderly people, get them on the phone, and ask them, say, we're going to wire you $10,000, but you have to wire us $1,000 first as a registration fee. Well, First Financial decided, took a look at this, said, we are in a position to help people who are elderly protect themselves. And they set up as a model program, this elder care program, working with Adult Protective Services and the police department in Abilene, where they are basically putting people who scam these elderly citizens out of business. They are fleeing Abilene and the state of Texas because of this wonderful program that First Financial did. Think what a contribution that makes not only to the bank's customers, to their families, but to the community. I said, guys, talk about that. Don't talk about what banks need. Talk about what your customers need and what you did for these elderly people and what you're doing across the state. Stories are much better sales tools than anything else.
That's a great tip. Perfect. All right. Well, you have such an interesting perspective. So I'd love to ask you about the use of humor in the media, as I think that that's going to be something that would intimidate many listeners. But I think if it could be done effectively, then it's a wonderful tool.
Well, humor is a leadership tool. And I think it's an important thing for people to build into their skill set as they rise in any career. When we talk about humor in the media, what we're really talking about is self-deprecating humor so people know that you don't take yourself so seriously. President Reagan was great about that, and we have lots of examples of one-liners that he would toss off that helped dispel the image of him as somebody who was unapproachable, or in his case, somebody who was an older person. And one of my favorites is that he would raise the topic of age with people, and he'd say, you know, Thomas Jefferson said, what matters isn't age, is experience. And then he'd pause and he'd say, and you know, ever since he told me that, and of course, everybody would laugh. When I was in the White House, a rumor came out about the president falling asleep in cabinet meetings. And Jim Baker, our chief of staff, was livid about it. But President Reagan thought it was hilarious. And for months after that, in any meeting, he would say, somebody asked a question, and he'd say, could you repeat that? I must have dozed off. And it always got a laugh, but it was quick. It basically poked fun at himself. And that's what you want to do. You want to poke fun at yourself as a way of being a real person and a real human being. And one of the lessons of that is when you get a good line, use it over and over again.
I see. And are there any overarching tips?
Well, the ones that I use on myself is one I mentioned earlier about how I took my resume and turned it into a bio to cover up the fact that I could never hold a job for more than a year. Another line I like frequently when I give a lot of speeches, people are always very gracious and effusive in their introductions. And I will tell the story of Kathy Black, who was the publisher of USA Today for years and is a friend of mine and my age. And her mother once said to her, Kathy, you agree to give speeches so that you can listen to yourself be introduced, which is a funny line. I think if you poke fun at yourself in a way that makes people smile, we're not looking for belly laughs. We're just looking to lighten the conversation a little bit, again, so that people know that you're a human being and you don't take yourself too seriously.
That's great. I'm just curious, is there something that you could put your finger on that inspires your leadership style?
That's a good question. I think I've been inspired by the people that I've worked for, by my faith, I'm a believer, by family, and by our country. You know, Carl, we are so blessed to live in this country. I wouldn't aggrandize myself to say I'm a student of history, but when you look back at the history of this country, and I do believe in American exceptionalism, we stand on the shoulders of our ancestors, like so many other people. My family were immigrants. My great-grandfather came over in the 1890s as a teenage blacksmith's assistant, married, raised a family, had eight children, sent all eight of his children, four boys and four girls, to college. And I look back at the achievements and sacrifice of the people who've come before me, and I want them to be proud of me. I want to justify what they put into coming to this country so I could have opportunities.
Excellent. Thank you. What is the minimal best training for public communicators?
Well, of course, I'm a great believer, Carl, that the foundation of communication is being a good writer. And I worry about that today with all the new types of communication, which place a premium on brevity. But I would say to anybody who's interested in communication, and I tell my students at the Cox School of Business, where I teach the graduate school students, whatever business you think you're in the business of communication. We expect you to manage communication. We expect you to understand that communication is a strategic business tool and a leadership skill. And so I would just tell people, start writing as early as you can and write a lot. I am continually shocked by people who are very smart and very competent, and who really cannot even write a decent letter. The second thing I would tell them is read. One of the other things that's of concern to me today is that people don't read. They will visually absorb, they will listen, but they don't read. And reading, and particularly reading good writing, is absolutely fundamental. And there are certain things that I think every literate American should have read. A couple of the Federalist Papers, some of the Founding Fathers documents, Lincoln's inaugural speeches, a few things like that, where the power of the words really inspires you and teaches you what good writing sounds like. If there's anybody here who hasn't read at a minimum and read aloud the Gettysburg Address, that's their first assignment.
Okay. I'll take that homework.
We have a category that we talk about that we call, you can pay a lot for bad advice. And Your listeners may remember that in 2010, there was a young woman who was the Republican candidate for the U.S. Senate in Delaware, and her opponent found an ancient TV show that she had done as a guest some 20 years before, where she had talked about being a Wiccan and witchcraft. She'd been a college student. You know, we all do dumb things. I'm just glad people didn't have cell phones when I was in college. And of course, they played this thing over and over and over again. And the young woman was persuaded by her campaign consultants to cut and pay for a television ad in which there was a black background and she had on a black dress. The camera came on and she said, "I'm not a witch." Well, that was the end of the campaign. You know, her consultants should have told her this is a terrible idea. Even if she fired them, it was a bad idea. And we've got a number of these things where people, I think, were afraid to tell the people who were paying the bill what they really thought. And that ends up being very bad advice.
I see. You've got great stories. And I'm very happy to plug the Bimbo memo because I think it's really fun. And I spent some time with it before our call today. And I was laughing. So do you want to give a little bit of information and background on the Bimbo memo?
Yeah, the Bimbo memo reminds people that you never repeat and deny a negative because of how the listener hears it. And it goes back to the young woman we mentioned a little bit earlier in the conversation, caught with a married man who held a press conference and said, "I'm not a bimbo," thus causing everyone to think that she was. And we put the memo out monthly, and it's the three best, if you'll pardon the use of that word, bimbos of the month. And then you can click through it to what we call the full bimbo, which is where there's everything that I've collected over the month. And actually, Carl, that's where my favorite category is, which is called wrong thing to say. And we actually have in this month's top three an example of the wrong thing to say. Usually it's back in the full memo, but the coach of the Grizzlies, the Memphis team, was just hired by the Nets. And he was just doing an interview and the reporter said, "You know, are you excited about moving to New York?" And he said, "I'm so excited." He said, "After Memphis, you know, they're in the Stone Age, like they don't have electricity or anything." Well, you can imagine the reaction of the citizens of Memphis, who considered themselves rather supportive of him. And certainly in the modern age, I mean, his name is Mud there. But the Bimbo memo is very funny, and it's designed to illustrate what we think is important, that is to be a serious teaching tool, but also to make people laugh. And we usually take, there's usually a dig at a lawyer. There's usually a lawyer who says something like, "My client did not commit fraud intentionally." Okay. So it's a reminder, but it's designed to be funny. And yes, I would encourage your listeners. The website is www.spathcom, my last name, spathcom.com. And please do sign up.
Perfect. And I'll make sure to have a link in the show notes so that people can get there from my site as well. Very happy to
Excellent.
Do that. Absolutely. Well, we've taken up a lot of your time. I had a question. What related work are you most proud of doing and why?
Well, we've had so many opportunities at this point. I think the thing I would point to would be the White House News Service, you know, back in the early 1980s that I mentioned as we started talking about it when the internet was just getting started, because I recognized the need to get outside of Washington. I recognized the need to invent a new way to communicate with reporters around the country, a new way to give them access to the White House. And maybe I shouldn't say it was the first thing, Carl, but it was certainly one of the first things that established that communication was going to be very different going forward. It would be democratized. And it was, I think it played a very important role. I have letters from President Reagan up on my wall where he thanks me for what it did for him in being able to reach the American public and get his message out. So I think I would point to that. But again, it all came because I had great opportunities.
That's so cool.
Well, I'm glad you think it's cool. My children will now say, "But Mom, that's the last century." Okay. And then they figured out it was the last millennium, which I think is even funnier. And, you know, Carlton, my students at the Cox School of Business, they were just being born, my graduate students, when Reagan was in office. So to them, Reagan is a historic figure, you know, like FDR or Lincoln. And to me, of course, President Reagan was a real person.
Right. I think you might enjoy waxing poetic a little bit on the future, since you've seen the way that what is currently the modern media has grown up a bit. I'm curious to hear how you feel the future may play out.
I do. Thank you for the opportunity. And I'm going to start by telling you a story about the Irving Chamber of Commerce, which has just hired a very bright reporter from the Dallas Morning News as their communications director. And she reports that as a reporter, she would come and interview you. She'd do it with a print publication, of course, but she'd have her iPhone and she would do a short video interview with you. She'd also take pictures of it. She'd enter all of that online, and then she was expected to interact with you as the reader. If you posted comments, she was expected to post comments back. That's the wave of the future in terms of media. Multimedia, immediacy, and engagement. And it also has huge implications for all of our corporate clients in terms of how they think of interacting with their audiences, particularly employees and customers. Communication is going to be democratized. You need to engage the audience and engage them along all these different channels. It's important to do that because if you don't do it with them, they're going to go engage themselves elsewhere. So that's what I see as the future. Multimedia, multi-channel, lots of engagement, lots of back and forth, volatility, timelines shrunk down to just the immediate.
Excellent.
Exciting, but also kind of scary.
What do you think we should do as communicators to prepare ourselves for what might come?
I tell people, I think what we have to do is engage. Okay. Get out there, compete for attention, invent your own media, because today the first thing people do is go to the internet. So even though the traditional mainstream media, which is struggling, I might say, I mean, they're shrinking, you and I are growing. You know, we're where the growth is.
Right.
It's on our side.
Engage,
create your own media, involve your own audiences, customers and employees in particular, solicit their stories, find a way, we call it magnetizing it, find websites where people can share their pictures, their stories, their experiences. I just don't think you can do too much of that today.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for taking the time today and for being so generous with your knowledge, really. Greatly appreciated. Before we part, first, is there anything that you would like to cover or leave people with? And next, what's you gave your website. Is there are there any other ways that you'd like people to engage with you?
We have a book on Amazon now called You Don't Say. That's actually a collection of Bimbo comments reorganized as a teaching tool. If anybody is on Amazon, I think they'll find it very funny and very useful. So I would mention that. And, if people would sign on to the Bimbo, all of those submissions come from our readers around the world. So we want to practice what we preach. Engage with us. Send us things that your listeners like or think that are funny or think that other people could learn from.
Love it. Let's democratize together.
Absolutely. Right. You're the future.
Wonderful. Okay. I think we're probably okay.
Absolutely. This has been a lot of fun. We've certainly covered a lot of territory, and it's just wonderful to engage with you in this kind of medium and with your listeners.
Well, I'm sincerely proud to have you on the show. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. I'm going to say toodaloo.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
When I first met Mary, she was giving a related presentation in DC to a museum auditorium full of communications professionals. I had a strong inclination that she would be a great teacher. I hope after listening to this episode you agree. After the presentation, I was compelled to raise my hand and ask Mary, "What is the best minimal training for public communicators?" And her response was so helpful that I had to write her words down. She said, "Have a point of view. Decompartmentalize. All audiences need to hear the same message. Have courage, be organized, and rehearse." Lastly, she said, "You can learn a lot from bad examples." There's no doubt that Mary is a positive leader who practices what she preaches. If you notice how adeptly she handled my lightly set up and purposefully negative question, there was a brilliant case study in the span of 20 seconds. In short, know the greatness of your message, keep the interviews or attention focused on the positivity of your message, and on track with your goals. Thanks for listening, folks. Cheers.